Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 186 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 26 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. Today, I am bringing you the third of my series of behind-the-screen episodes in which I discuss the creation, preparation, and running of my latest RPG campaign, a D&D campaign called Hinterlands of Alandria. So this is going to be the audio from a YouTube live stream that I did. So if you would like to see the video that goes with this, you can find that on my YouTube channel. And I'll go ahead and embed that video in the show notes for this episode at starwalkerstudios.com. However, I did hear from some listener GMs who said that they would really appreciate having these as part of the audio podcast because not everybody has time to sit around and watch YouTube all day. And some of you are on the go and listening to this show while you're doing your various things. So that's why I'm including these as part of the podcast. And I think that these behind the screens are very relevant to what we discuss on this show, which is the craft and art of game mastering. And what better way to get at that than to learn by example, and you can watch me run this campaign and we can talk about how I prepared for it, all the things that happened versus what I thought would happen and things like that. So that's what we're doing today. Really quickly, though, before we get to that, I want to remind you that you can get Game Master's Journey and other Star Walker Studios t-shirts and other memorabilia. You can find a link to our store over on Spreadshirt in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. And also want to remind you that I have a self-published D&D adventure that is available as well called The Trickster's Labyrinth. So I hope that you will check those out, and getting a t-shirt or getting my adventure are great ways that you can support the show and support Star Walker Studios. I want to thank everyone for the feedback that I've gotten on the behind the screen episodes. And I want to remind you that if you are watching the actual play or you're watching or listening to these episodes, and you have any comments or questions or things you'd like me to talk about the campaign, please let me know. Probably the best way to do that is just to comment on the video that you're referring to over on my YouTube channel. You can also email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. And you can also find all the various other ways you can get in touch with me over at starwalkerstudios.com. So again, this is the third in my series of behind the screen episodes, and today I am talking about preparing for the first game session. Hello, gamer. Welcome to the third in my behind the screen episodes in which I go behind the DM screen and talk about my campaign. I'm running Hinterlands of Alandria. This is a companion to my Hinterlands of Alandria D&D campaign that I'm live streaming here on YouTube, and also a companion to my RPG podcast, Game Master's Journey. So one of my goals with Game Master's Journey and with the campaign is to use this as a way to help newer GMs or help any GMs who are looking to improve their craft. And I thought a great way to get at this is to discuss a campaign that I'm actually running and discuss the planning and the preparation, as well as the actual game sessions, what goes down at the table, and give you an opportunity to ask questions or make suggestions of things that you'd like discussed. So if you've ever been watching a D&D or other RPG game and you've seen the GM do something or not do something and you wondered why, this is your chance to get those kinds of questions answered. So as I said, this is the third in the series. And previously, I gave an introduction to my homebrew setting of Primordia. And in the second episode, I talked a bit about some of the preliminary prep and thought I put into the campaign itself, even before characters were made or even before I recruited players for the campaign. Also in this playlist are the seven preludes that we did for the campaign. And at this point, we've had, I believe now, three game sessions that we've actually played. So today, what I'm going to talk about is the preparation for the first session. So today I'm talking about preparation for session one, Into the Wilds. I believe that's what it was called. Let me verify that real quick. Yes. So I talked about before, but in case this is the first of these videos that you've watched or the first of these podcast episodes that you've listened to, by necessity, some of these are time shifted a bit. So today I'm talking about preparing for session one, but I've already run sessions one, two, and three. And the reason for that is because my players like to watch these videos. And so I don't want to spoil the campaign for the players. And also for those of you watching the actual play and enjoying it from more of an entertainment perspective, I don't want to spoil the campaign for you with these kind of behind the scenes discussions. So that's why, even though we've played three sessions, today I'm talking about preparing for the first session, because what I'm talking about today isn't going to spoil anything that hasn't happened yet in game. So if you're brand new to this channel or to this campaign and you haven't watched anything else yet, this might spoil some things that have already happened in the first few sessions. But if you're otherwise caught up, this isn't going to spoil anything that you haven't seen yet, whether you're a player or just someone watching. So because of that, I want to be very clear which episode or which game session I'm talking about. So today we're talking about the first session, Into the Wilds. And I'm going to talk about kind of some things I thought about preparing for the session, because one of the most common questions I get from listeners of Game Master's Journey is, how do you prepare for a game session, or how do you prepare for a campaign? So hopefully by talking about how I prepared for this particular session, I can help those of you out that are wondering those things. So if you're watching this live, I'm live streaming this right now, feel free to participate in the chat room here on YouTube. Feel free to ask any questions that you have about the first session. I'd love to hear your questions. If you're watching this later and you're not watching it live, and you have any questions or there's something that I talk about that you'd like me to go more detail on, feel free to comment on this video and I will address those in later installations of Behind the Screen. So really quickly, before I get into my outline here, let me check and make sure there aren't any comments or questions on this first session that I don't already have covered in my notes. And nope, I don't see any questions right now on the first session. Now, this is a pretty new campaign. This is a pretty new playlist on my YouTube channel. So I realize that there will probably be people who find this later and watch this later and, you know, maybe have questions about the first session, and I'm not going to talk about those today because you haven't asked them yet. But still feel free to comment and ask questions on that first session video. And I will definitely refer to those for future episodes of this behind the screen series. But since I don't have any right now, that's okay. I have things to talk about all on my own. And again, any of you watching live, maybe you might have some questions or comments as we go through this. And periodically, or at the very least at the end of this video, I will refer to the YouTube chat to see if there's anything else you'd like me to talk about. So one thing I want to say at the top of this is in some of these preliminary episodes where I'm talking about preparing for sessions I haven't run yet, sometimes the session number is a guess. Now in this case, it's not because I've already run session one, but in this series, I will talk about how I'm planning ahead and how I'm outlining for future sessions. And I just want to make sure everybody understands that if I'm talking about something I haven't done yet, I'm kind of guessing, you know, that this thing is going to happen in the third session, for instance. Like, I don't know until I run the game how much we're going to get done in a given session. But in this specific case, I do know what happened in session one because I've already run it. We've already done it. So in preparing for this first session, in planning for it, I'm going to kind of now shift my thinking and try to go back in time to before I ran this session and speak from the point of view of me back in the past, planning and preparing for this, because that's what we're talking about today, you know, preparing for a session that you haven't run yet. So my thoughts as far as kind of in general what is going to happen in this session is the player characters are going to be brought together as a group for the first time by their patron and by their sponsor in the Guild of Adventurers, Druenda. Now, through the character creation and the preludes and fleshing out everyone's backstory, we have determined that there are some of the characters who may know one another. But overall, in general, for the most part, these characters are strangers to one another at this point, have never worked together before. So they're brought together by this NPC, Druenda, that I've talked about in previous episodes, who is has chosen them, has hand-selected them from people who are not yet members of the Guild of Adventurers to go on a mission for her and to do a job for her and also indirectly for the guild. And this mission is simply to investigate a dream she had of an independent village in the hinterlands east of the city of Alondria. And it's believed that there aren't any villages or towns or anything like that out there anymore. And for more of that, you can refer to the previous episodes of Behind the Screen. I talk about that in detail. So Druenda, being a seer, has this dream that she believes is a dream of a real thing, this village, and sends the player characters to investigate, to find out, is this village really out there? And if so, how have they survived on their own for 5 years when it's believed that's not possible and no one was able to do that? Each of the player characters are given a few things to help them on their way by Druenda. She gives each of them some supplies in the form of rations, you know, a mess kit, bedroll, some basic kind of things that you need to go out in the wilds by yourself. You know, these are not professional adventurers, so she's not going to assume that they know what to pack. So she gives them the essentials. And she also gives each player character a potion of healing. Now, I originally considered the idea that Druenda would be available to advise the PCs on how to equip themselves for the journey, but that it would be up to them to do so. So my first idea of how I was going to handle this was that I was going to leave it up to the players and up to their characters to decide, you know, what they want to bring, what kind of supplies they need for this expedition and all that kind of stuff. And they could have asked Druenda for advice and said, hey, you know, what should we take? But it would have been up to them to do that and to ask her and get that information. And I was kind of thinking that this would be sort of like their first challenge, their first test, you know, as, you know, a party that's well prepared and brings the things that they need to survive on their own would have a much easier time completing their mission than one that doesn't. However, ultimately, I decided against this course of action, and I decided instead of leaving it up to the players to decide what kind of equipment and supplies are going to take with them, that I'd have Druinda give her the basic stuff that they would need. And the main reason that I did this was because as I started actually planning for this first session and kind of thinking about, you know, how is this going to go, kind of visualizing the sequence of the scenes in my mind for that first session, it occurred to me that beginning a game session and beginning a campaign with basically a, quote, shopping episode wasn't the greatest way to start out a new campaign. And the more I thought about it, the more I was concerned that if I went this way, that, you know, who knows how much time we would burn in that first session between the players discussing what kinds of things they should bring, and then actually going and buying and getting a hold of those things and blah, 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 blah. And the more I thought about it, the more I could see us spending an hour or more of our 3-hour session basically shopping and getting ready to go on the journey. So I was afraid that if I started out that way, that it could easily bog things down for this first session and end up with them really not getting anything accomplished. I mean, you could even see them not even getting out of the city in that first session, depending how, you know, indecisive the players are, how quickly they agree on what they need, how much they want to role play, actually, you know, interacting with merchants and haggling prices and all this stuff. And for the first session of a campaign, I'd really much rather get into the action and get to something exciting and interesting and, you know, get to the fun parts. I don't want to spend a whole session where we don't really accomplish much. And when the players look back, they're like, oh, wow, all we did for that first session was, you know, buy mundane supplies. I mean, that's not going to be a very rewarding game session and not a great way to start out a campaign. Another concern I had was that if I start out in the city of Alandria, that there are countless ways that the players could be delayed or distracted from beginning this mission, that it's really what kicks off the campaign. They could want to go visit and talk with various NPCs from their backstory or explore the city, or, you know, there's all kinds of things that they could do and rabbit holes they could go down and never end up leaving the city in the first session. Right now, at this stage in the campaign, I want the focus to be on exploration. And I want to get into the action as quickly as we can. I don't want to, you know, start this campaign with no momentum and have that this first section be really boring and players are twiddling their thumbs waiting for something to happen. So for all these reasons, I decided to just have Druinda provide them with some things that they would need. And I also decided to actually start the adventure with them already on the journey in Media Res, so to speak, to avoid the chance of getting bogged down in the city and not going anywhere. So I actually, before I ran the session, I changed this yet again. And I think in a way at least came to regret that. But I think I will either discuss that later in this episode or I'll discuss it in a future episode when I talk about what actually happened in that session, you know, what I think went well, what didn't go so well, kind of the post game or the after action or after adventure report, if you will. So another thing I was thinking about at this stage of the game was this journey that they need to make. So I talked about in previous behind the screen how I decided that this village that's out there is about 3 days travel from Alandria. And I picked that figure because I wanted it to be far enough away that they can't just go back to the city every day or whenever they have a whim to go back to the city. I wanted to not have it be that accessible, but I wanted it to be close enough that if they really needed to go to the city some way, they could. But if they did so at a low level, it would be kind of an adventure in and of itself, just getting back to the city. So I decided 3 days travel seems like a good amount where it's far enough away that they're not going to be going back all the time, but it's close enough to where if they need to go back, they can. The other thought behind having a journey involved, getting from the city to where they're going to look for this village, is I wanted to show the players that the wilds, which is to say the wilderness or basically all of the world outside of these handful of cities that are left, it's a very dangerous place. And there's very good reasons why, for the most part, people don't go out in the wilds. So the best way to do that is actually show the players by having them make a journey, having their characters make a journey, and having them have some dangerous encounters on the way. And I think as low-level characters, even something as simple as a 3-day journey through the wilds is going to be a challenge. And it's not something that I want to just hand wave because it is a challenge. There is a chance for failure. There is a chance for something interesting happening. So I don't want to just skip it. Also, if I hand wave away that section of the journey and I say, oh, you guys travel for 3 days, no problem, you know, there's no issues, then I'm undermining what I'm trying to do here, which is to establish this sense of danger and to let the players know that, hey, once you leave the protection of the city, you're in a very dangerous place and you need to be careful and all this stuff. So having low-level characters make a 3-day uneventful journey directly undermines that and sends the opposite message, sends the message of, oh, it's not that bad. We traveled for 3 days and didn't have any problems. However, on the other hand, I also don't want to spend too much time on this journey because ultimately this journey isn't what the story is about, isn't what I want to be doing at this stage of the campaign. I don't want to spend numerous sessions, for instance, or even a whole session on this journey, just with them getting to the area where the campaign is actually going to take place. So kind of weighing all these things, I came up with a solution that I liked, that I felt did the things that I was trying to do, which is namely show that, you know, traveling through the wilds isn't a simple affair, that it is dangerous, but at the same time, not take up too much of this first session with the journey to the campaign area. I'd like them to get to the campaign area. And at this point in the game, in the preparation, I was thinking that I was going to try to pace it so that they would find the village at the end of the first session. I liked the idea of kind of ending with the cliffhanger of they've found the village, they see it in the distance, they know it's a real thing now, they can tell there's people there, but then that's the end of the session. And the next session, we find out what's up with the village and they actually get to go and explore it. Part of that was because, you know, ending on a cliffhanger is always a good idea. It helps the players remember what's happening the next week or the next time you play. It's just, and I've found this from both sides of the screen as a player and a GM, it really helps you remember where you were at and what you were doing and what was going on if you end the session in the middle of something interesting or exciting happening, as opposed to ending the session where there's not much going on. And then it seems like players tend to not as well remember where they were at and what was happening. So I always like to end on some kind of a cliffhanger if I can. And I thought that would be a cool place to end that first session, is with them finding the village, but not yet having a chance to investigate it. As it turned out, I have proven again and again that I'm not very good at predicting how far players will get through what I have prepared. And we ended up getting to the village at the end of the second session. So I was still able to do the cliffhanger that I wanted and end a session with them seeing the village in the distance and then begin the next session with them entering the village. It just happened at the end of the second session instead of the first session. And part of the reason I think it turned out that way was because of a last minute change that I made, in which instead of starting with them on their journey already, I decided to do an opening scene with Druinda in the city and give the players a chance in character to kind of get to know one another. Because the reason I did that is I was thinking about it and I was like, well, they would have at least met once before they left. And originally I was thinking I would skip that so I could start the campaign in media res and avoid any kind of slow start to the campaign. I found in my experience as a GM that usually beginning a campaign with some kind of role-playing scene usually doesn't go well because the players aren't yet sure who their characters are. It's always a little awkward in the beginning. No one's sure exactly what to do, what to say. They don't have storylines to pursue. They don't have any history to draw on. So to just put them in a situation where there's not much of anything happening and you just expect them to role-play with one another, it usually just ends up, you know, people staring at each other and kind of never really goes well. So I usually try not to start campaigns that way. But, you know, I ended up second guessing myself and thinking, well, they would have met together at some point. And, you know, maybe I should give the players a chance to role play that if they want to. And in retrospect, I think maybe I shouldn't have done that. And it would have been a stronger opening to the campaign if I would have begun in media res like I originally planned. But again, we'll talk about that more when we talk about how the first session actually went and my reactions to it. So getting back to this idea of travel, my solution that I came up with is that the guild would provide the player characters with flying mounts. And the reason I did this was to achieve the goals I was trying to achieve. You know, I've said before, I always have a purpose for anything I'm doing in a campaign, anything I'm preparing. So the purpose of the journey is to show the players that traveling the wilds is dangerous and shouldn't be taken lightly. That's it. That's what I want to accomplish with this journey. And I don't want to eat up the whole session to do it. I want to be able to get to them looking for the village in the first session and hopefully get to them finding the village by the end of the first session. So if I have them travel that distance on foot, which again would take 3 days, or by a horse, which would take 3 days, then it's either going to take longer than a session to really represent what 3 days of travel in this environment would be like, because they're going to have numerous encounters, or I'm going to be hand waving encounters or skipping encounters or something like that. So the way that I thought of to where I could have the journey impress the danger, but not have it take too long is, well, let's give them flying mounts. So the thought was that the guild could provide the player characters with flying mounts to get them to the area where they are going to begin their search for the village. The mounts would then return to the city, so the player characters can't rely on them to get back. They're going to have to find their own way back. And then in this way, I can begin this first session with a brief description of their journey via the flying mounts, which I came up with my own flying mount for this. I got the idea of using a Stellar's Blue Jay and coming up with a giant version of that. So we've got like the giant eagle, right? Well, in Primordia, there's now a giant jay, which is a Stellar's Blue Jay, which is a specific kind of blue jay that we have here in Washington. So actually, I can show you what one looks like. Just in case you haven't seen the actual play, I can really quickly here, I think, show you what that looks like. There we go. So that's what they look like. So depending where in the country or the world you live, this might be a giant or what you think of as a blue jay. Or may not. I know I originally grew up in Indiana and our blue jays look different than this. So basically the PCs are given mounts that are giant versions of these birds that they're able to ride to the campaign area. So I can begin the session with a brief description of this trip, which instead of taking 3 days, only takes them 7 hours, since they're on a flying mount that has a higher speed than humans or a horse would, and can fly as the crow flies, doesn't have to follow a road or something like that, doesn't have to deal with difficult terrain. And as far as to get the danger aspect of it across, I decided I could do some kind of encounter on the way while they're flying, an aerial encounter. And this way we can get to the campaign area pretty quickly in less than a session, but the players will hopefully realize that getting back to Alondria will not be as easy as it was getting here. And that will be an undertaking in and of itself, and not something that will necessarily be done easily. In addition to the basic equipment and the healing potion, Drunda also gives the group a sending stone, which is a magic item that allows you to cast the sending spell once per day to someone who has a matching sending stone. The sending spell lets you send a 25-word message, which then the person you're sending the message to can reply with their own 25-word message. As we joked in the game, it's like D&D Twitter, basically. So Drunda gives them the stone so that they have a way that they can report back to her. And she asks them to report back once a day, and to report when they find the village. She also, plans to contact them as well, using her sending stone if need be, to get updates on their progress. So the player character's first task upon arriving in the area when these giant jays drop them off will be to find the village. So I thought about different ways that I could handle this search for the village. And basically, all the different ideas that I came up with as far as ways to handle this boiled down to two general methods. So the first method I could use is I could come up with an actual hex map of the area and use the systems given in the DMG, where I start the player characters out in a hex. They make survival rolls to see if they know where they are, which hex they are on the map. And then they explore each hex, and I would just give the players a truncated version of this map, with fog of war, and say, okay, here's where you're at. You're in this hex. You've got, six other hexes around you. Which one are you going to explore? And just let the players, explore hex by hex until they find the right one. So that's the one way I could do it. The other way I could do it is a more narrative, a more theater of the mind approach, where I don't show them a hex map. I don't have them, choose hexes on a map to explore. I instead handle it narratively and just set the scene and say, what is your strategy to find this village? How are you going to look for it? Maybe they make some checks. Maybe they just set off in a random direction, or however they decide to do it. So I had to decide, which of these methods do I want to use? Let's see. So in the end, I decided to go with the more theater of the mind approach, and I'll explain why. So with the hex map method, how long it takes the player characters to find the village will be pretty much determined by how well they do on their checks to navigate and know where they are and not get lost, and also just which hexes they decide to explore. So if I have a hex map and I decide, the village is in this hex over here, the players could find it fairly quickly if they happen to head right toward that hex and pick the right hex to begin with. Or it could take them forever to find it if they go the completely wrong direction, or they're just unlucky as far as which hexes they choose to explore. And unless I move where the village is on the map, which of course I could do, but unless I do that, it's kind of out of my hands as a DM how long this takes. It could take a session. It could take 8 sessions. And it's completely almost random how long it takes because the players don't really necessarily know which hex to explore unless I give them some kind of clues or something. Also, you know, part of my inspiration for this campaign is the West Marches, and it's not very West Marches to give the players a map at the beginning of the campaign, because part of the whole idea behind West Marches is you're exploring an unexplored area and there are no maps. And part of what the player characters are doing is exploring and even mapping the area so that people can know what's out there and where things are. So, you know, you kind of short circuit that if you give them a map and it's like, here's your map. It's like, there is no map. They have to create the map, right? So that was the two main things I was thinking about. You know, it's not really very West Marches to give them a map. And if I do go the hex route, I have no control over how long it takes the players to find the village. They could find it right away. You know, they pick the right hex first, which isn't ideal. I'd like it to take a little bit of time. Or it could take them numerous sessions to find, or they might never find it, which none of these are ideal for what I'm trying to accomplish here. So because of that, I decided let's go with a more theater of the mind approach. And what I finally decided to do is I would have the players make a survival check, DC 15, for the day's navigation. And this is right out of the Dungeon Master's Guide. We see this system used in Tomb of Annihilation, the new adventure by Wizards. Pretty standard fare. You make a survival check, DC 15, for that day's navigation, and if you succeed, then you know where you are and you're where you think you are. If you fail, you're lost. And then you know, if you're using a hex map, and this is exactly how we would do it with a hex map too. If you're using a hex map and you're lost, then the DM rolls a D6 to see which way out of the hex they go. And you don't show them again where they are on the map until they succeed at a survival check to figure out where they are again. And they could end up lost for days on end and end up very far from where they think they are. So that's the way you would handle it if you were using the hex map, but I'm not using that. I'm going to do more theater of the mind. So they make the survival check just to see how well are you navigating? How well are you determining where you are and where you're going and all that good stuff. If they fail this check, it means they don't know where they are. They're totally lost. They might still find the village. They could still find the village if they fail the survival check. They just don't know where the village is when they find it in relation to anything else. So there's the one survival check, just once per day check, just for basic navigation. In addition to that, each hour that they search for the village, I have them make a perception check and an investigation check. Both of these are DC 15. And this is just kind of a way to allow different player characters with different skills to contribute to what the group is trying to do, which is find this village. So perception represents, you know, being able to see signs. They were given some landmarks by Druinda to look for. So perception represents actually noticing those landmarks if they're around, just, you know, how much are you noticing? How well are you perceiving what's around you? And the investigation check represents your actual searching for the village and in your system or your method that you're using, whatever that is, to find this village. How well is that working out for you? And the idea here is they get to make each of these checks once per hour, and different PCs can make the check. So one player character can make the perception check, and a different player character can make the investigation check. They can also aid each other. So the basic system in 5th edition is if one character helps another character do a thing, then the character who's being helped gets advantage on the roll to do the thing. So basically, you could have two player characters working together on the perception check, which gives whoever makes the check advantage, and you could have two player characters working together on the investigation check, which gives the person making that check advantage, which, you know, greatly increases their odds of success. And I'm involving 4 of the player characters out of 6 in the group in this search for the village. So it's not just one character doing everything. And there's nothing to say that the same characters have to make the check every hour either. So every time they fail one of these checks, it means that they have some kind of encounter during that hour. It could be an encounter with a monster or an animal or something like that. It could be some kind of natural hazard or really whatever I want the encounter to be. But something interesting happens when they fail a check. If they succeed at one or more of those two checks they make every hour, I instead roll to see if they have an encounter that hour. So if they fail a check, they automatically have an encounter. If they succeed at the check, there's just a chance they have an encounter, and I roll a d20. If I roll an 18 or higher, then they have an encounter. So that means they have a 15% chance of an encounter per hour if they succeed at both the checks. And then they need to accumulate 6 successes total on these checks. And these are the hourly checks, not the daily navigation check. These are the hourly perception investigation checks. They need to accumulate 6 successes to find the village. So the quickest way they could find it, if they succeed at both checks every hour, is 3 hours, right? They make 2 checks every hour. That's 2 successes an hour times 3 hours is 6 successes. So if you know, they succeed at every check, they'll find it in 3 hours. Otherwise, it will take longer. And I felt that was hitting kind of my target, which is I'd like them to find the village this session, unless they're incredibly unlucky or they just take up a lot of time role playing or whatever. But I'm shooting for them finding the village in this session. And I'm like, well, if it's only 3 checks, and that's a maximum of 3 encounters, we should be able to do that in our 3-hour session. And remember, if they're succeeding at the checks, then there's only a 15% chance of an encounter anyway. So odds are they're not going to have an encounter each of those 3 hours. On the other hand, if they fail some of those checks, then they may have more encounters. It may take longer than 3 hours, and it might take more than 1 session, but it shouldn't take more than 2. Because a DC 15 check, assuming whoever's making the check is proficient, which I'm sure they would be, and they're aiding each other so they have advantage, it's like they've got at least a 50% chance or close to a 50% chance to make that check. So they shouldn't really be failing it that many times. So I thought that was pretty good. I'm like, okay, if they're really unlucky, maybe it'll take us a little more than 1 session, but definitely shouldn't take us more than 2. And I felt like that's kind of where I wanted to be. So like I said, my ideal for this was I was hoping they would find the village by the end of the first session. And so that's kind of what I was thinking as far as this system I came up with. So, you know, this system, I pretty much invented it, right? I mean, I didn't invent it whole cloth. I took things from here and there. Right. So I got the survival check for navigation. That's right from the DMG. But then I wanted some kind of system to determine how long it takes them to find the village. I wanted the player characters to be able to either increase or decrease the amount of time it takes based on how well they roll, and also based on strategies that they use, which could affect the roles or affect the difficulties. And also the player characters or the players also have an impact on potentially how many encounters they have to deal with before they find the village. So it'll be fun to talk about how this actually panned out. All right. That's the lion's share of what I wanted to talk about as far as preparing for this first session. And I see we've got some people in the chat. So let's see what's going on in the chat. Hello, Jerome and Rob. Okay, so Rob asks a question. He says, I was wondering if the guild maintains a small compound just outside the bubble from which they could teleport people to nearby locations. That's a great... Having back problems today. I keep spasming. That's a great question, Rob. So to explain Rob's question for those of you that might be new to Primordia, the cities are protected by these magical bubbles, sort of like mythals in Forgotten Realms. And there was a recent cataclysm in the world which led to a lot of natural disasters, and the bubbles somewhat protected the city from those, and also led to a lot of interplanar rifts opening all over the place and horrible things pouring out of them. And this led to the destruction of most of the settlements in the world. The handful of cities that are still left were protected by these magical bubbles. And one of the things that the bubbles did was they prevented these rifts from opening inside the city. So you can imagine if you've got a city and all of a sudden a rift opens to, say, I don't know, the abyss in the middle of your city and demons start pouring out, like, that's bad, right? And you could see how that'd be, you know, hard to cope with, and how city walls and a moat and all that good stuff doesn't protect you from a rift to the abyss opening in the middle of your city. So, you know, having these cities with these bubbles that prevented that from happening is what allowed people to survive these horrible events. So because of this bubble, it prevents any kind of magical travel across its boundary. So if you're, for instance, my city of Alandria is surrounded by one of these bubbles. So if you're within the city, you can teleport, for instance, from one part of the city to another, no problem. But you can't teleport out of the city. You can't teleport outside of the bubble. You can't go across that boundary. In the same way, if you're outside the city of Alandria, you can't teleport into the city. Again, you can't go across that boundary. If you're inside the city, you can't, for instance, plane shift or gate to another plane from inside the bubble, because it won't allow you to cross that boundary. So the way that the cities have gotten around this is they have these very special magical portals that are their own thing. They work different than portals in other worlds, and they're their own weird thing specific to Primordia. They're made using an ancient magic that people don't really understand anymore. And they allow travel from one bubble to another. But these portals are, two portals are linked together, are entangled. A great way to think of it are there two ends of a wormhole, basically. And so they're able to travel from one city to another that's protected by these bubbles by the portal. But that's the only way. So what Rob is asking here is, does the guild have a way to teleport people to and from the city outside the bubble? And yes, they do. There's actually a few things at work here. First of all, you can just leave the city, right? You can just go outside the outer gates. So I talked a bit about Alandria before in the introduction to the setting episode of this, which was the first behind the screen. And one thing I forgot to mention, I mentioned how there's the inner city that's thousands of years old, was built by elves, is surrounded by a wall. There's the outer city around that, which was built hundreds of years ago by humans, and around that is a wall. But what I forgot to mention in that episode is outside of that is the farm, is farmland around the city, and that area is enclosed by another wall. And it's outside of that wall that the bubble ends. So this bubble extends beyond the actual city into some of the farmland and the harbor, because the city's on the coast, a ways beyond that. But there's another wall out there where the bubble ends. So you can just travel outside that outermost wall into the wilds. And once you pass out of the perimeter of the bubble, then you can teleport wherever you want. Let me open my notebook for the campaign here, and I can tell you, since this is kind of related. So usually what happens with the guild is, you know, assuming we're starting with first level characters, that, you know, you don't start out in Primordia, first level character, you don't start out just automatically in the guild. You have to earn a place in the guild. And the way they determine if you're worthy of being in the guild or not is they have what they call the trials, which is really just a test. And it's not like a written test or anything like that. It's basically they send you on an adventure to prove that you're capable adventurers. And this is something you do as a team. So you don't join the Guild of Adventurers as an individual. You join as a team with another group of people that you're going to adventure with. So you come to the guild as part of a team. You say, hey, we want to become members of the guild. They send you on a trial. Usually what this is they will send you to some kind of ruin or basically a dungeon, right? In game terms, but some kind of ruin or structure or something that they want explored that's from some past age or civilization or whatever. And they send you there to explore it. And if you survive and explore it and return back, then you pass your test. So I actually did this. I ran a very short series of adventures here in my hometown of Bellingham for some players. And they did this. They went on the test. And right away when I was preparing for that, I had to solve the problem, which is what, you know, Rob is getting to here, which is, you know, how do we get from Primordia to somewhere else, you know, if we want an adventure or whatever. So the solution I came up with is an actual magic item called the Ring of Returning. And this is a 10-inch diameter ring. Seems to be made out of some kind of crystal. And the ring is large enough that up to 9 people can hold onto it with one hand. And basically the way this ring works is one of the mages of the guild, you know, usually a wizard or something like that, who can teleport, is able to teleport to the location where they're going to send the player characters for this test. And this is a location that someone from the guild has, I guess you could say, surveyed it. Someone has gone there and seen that, okay, there is something here to explore, but they haven't explored yet. So they have someone that can teleport there because they've been there before, or they've scryed it or something like that. So this person takes the player characters to the place where they're going to adventure, and they use this ring. And so the way it works is everybody puts their hand on the ring, including the person that teleports them. They teleport them to the location, which they have to leave the city. They have to leave that outer wall beyond the fields to do this, because you can't teleport from within the city to somewhere else. So they leave the city. They go just outside the wall, just outside the bubble. They use this ring. They teleport to where they want the player characters to go. Then the wizard teleports back home, back to outside, you know, the city wall where they came from, and leaves this magical ring with the player characters. And the player characters have to attune to the ring, but it's a special item that it can be attuned by more than one person. It's attuned by all the player characters. And then they usually set a period where the ring will return them back to where it came from. Usually it's 24 hours. And there's also like an activation word they can use to return at a different time. But basically, they're able to use this magical ring to teleport back to where the wizard teleported them from. So that's how the guild handles it with the trials. And the ring also will teleport itself back after a certain period of time on its own, in case like everybody dies or the ring gets stolen by a monster or something like that. There's like this fail safe that it eventually will teleport back all on its own. So that's how that's handled. So as far as going somewhere else, you just leave the city, you get outside the bubble, and you can teleport or gate or plane shift or astral travel or whatever you want to do. Now, as far as getting to the city, there is a teleportation circle outside of the city that can be used to get to Alandria from somewhere else. However, it's very secret. In fact, probably no one outside of the guild or outside of the queen herself actually knows that it exists. And even within the guild, you have to be fairly high rank in the guild before you learn about it. Like, you know, greenhorns don't learn about this thing. So it's very secret. The location is hidden, and it's very well guarded, because obviously, you know, that's a weakness in the security of the city. Even though it's outside the bubble, it's outside the walls, it's still fairly close to the city. So, you know, an invader that knew the sigil sequence for that teleportation circle could use it to to move troops in and things like that. I mean, it would take a while, but they could do it. So it's very closely guarded secret, but that does exist. So Rob also says, hope no one falls during the aerial encounter. And that's a really great point, Rob. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that's something I was thinking about when I was planning this. Is I was like, okay. So we've got this issue of, I want it to be a long trip. I want it to be dangerous, but I don't want it to take too long. And I also don't want to hand wave away encounters that should have happened if they're traveling by land. So I'm like, well, if they fly, that's going to bypass most encounters they would have. The only possible encounter they could have is with some other kind of flying creature, or, well, there's no surface to air missiles in Primordia, so we don't have to worry about, or artillery or anything like that. So it'd pretty much just be another flying creature would be the only thing they'd have to worry about. So I was like, so I can hand wave away this 7-hour flight and say nothing much happens and not defeat my purpose of getting the players to realize that it's dangerous, like I would if I hand waved a 3-day travel on land. But I still want to have at least one encounter to get that danger across, right? Like they shouldn't be able to make this whole flight without something happening. So I wanted there to be some kind of combat encounter with some kind of other flying creature or creatures, but I had to be very careful, because what Rob is referencing here is that falling, does damage, obviously, right? It's 1d6 per 10 feet to a maximum. It's either 10 or 20 d6. I don't remember. But at first, or actually the player characters were second level, that could easily kill you, especially at a height at which these birds would be flying. I mean, they're flying pretty high so that they can go faster and make this trip in 7 hours. So basically falling out of the saddle would be a death sentence. And if you're in a combat on aerial mounts, that's a very real possibility, right? That you could fall out of the saddle. So because I don't want that to happen, my goal, remember, again, everything has a purpose, right? My purpose for this aerial encounter is just to not have it be too easy and to reinforce, hey, this is dangerous. Even though you're flying, even though you've kind of found a loophole to avoid many of the dangers that you would have encountered otherwise, it's still not completely safe, so I'm going to have an encounter to show that. Because just telling the players that it's not safe isn't the same as them seeing it and experiencing it by having an encounter. But I want to be careful with this encounter, because I don't want to kill the PCs. My purpose here is not to kill player characters. My purpose is just to let them know that, hey, this is a dangerous thing you're doing. So I want to be careful. I want to be careful not to throw something too challenging at them. And I got to think about the whole falling issue, because if they get knocked out of the saddle, or if the bird they're on gets killed or incapacitated, they're going to fall and they're going to die. It doesn't matter what I roll in the dice. It's going to be more than double their hit points, which would kill them outright. So the way I decided to address that was two things. First of all, I made a point of illustrating to the players when they got the bird mounts that they're very almost kind of idiot proof. And that's kind of the point of these mounts, because giant eagles exist. There are, there's griffins and giant eagles and pegasi, and there's all kinds of flying mounts, hippogriffs that already exist in D&D, that exist in Primordia. I didn't need to come up with my own flying mount, but part of the idea behind these birds, they were developed by a wizard serving the previous queen, who just really liked these birds. And the wizard was like, hey, I'll bet she'd like having, ones that are big enough they could be used as mounts and kind of show the majesty of the royalty, right? Kind of a status kind of thing. But what turned out to be really useful about these mounts is they were not as aggressive as these more aggressive predators like eagles and griffins, which are very aggressive predators, which means they're easier to train, they're more docile, they take less skill to ride. If you're going to ride a giant eagle, you need to know what you're doing. You can't just put someone who's never ridden a giant eagle before on a saddle and hope they do well, right? So that was kind of the purpose of these mounts, is they're easier to deal with in that way. They're more docile. They're better domesticates than these, you know, more powerful predators. And as part of that, I decided that they have saddles that they basically like strap you in, and you can't fall out unless there's some kind of failure in the saddle, a strap breaks or something like that. You can't fall off. You can't just fail an animal handling check or something and fall out of the saddle. You're strapped in. It's physically impossible to fall out unless something happens to the saddle. So I made sure to establish that so that the players aren't wondering why they're not making rolls to see if they fall off the bird or not. And it actually worked out really well because I had them make an animal handling check just for funsies, just to kind of see. I mean, they didn't need a check to ride the birds. It's like idiot proof, like I said, and they just strap you in and you're along for the ride. But I had them make a check just to see, you know, how comfortable is your character with this? You know, if you roll really high on this check, it means like, oh, you're kind of a natural and you know how to like shift your weight with the movements of the bird. And, you know, it's a pleasant, easy experience for you, where if you roll really poorly on the check, then it means like you're more awkward. You're not as comfortable and things like that. It might have some effects at some point. And so Steve's character Malagar actually ended up rolling quite poorly on the check. Everybody else did pretty well. So I even had the tender of these birds that was kind of training them on how to ride them and everything and helping them out actually even used even more safety straps on Malagar because he was so obviously uncomfortable and awkward. You know, it's like, well, let's give him some peace of mind and also some added safety by we'll use these additional straps, you know, above and beyond what everybody else has. So that actually really, I think, did even more to kind of hang a lantern on the fact of, hey, you guys are strapped in. Unless something really bizarre happens, you don't have to worry about falling off as far as that goes. So that was one way I addressed it. And the other way I addressed it was with the encounter itself. And I considered a lot of different encounters with different things. I considered giant wasps, which are a flying creature I love to use at all times, especially lower levels. But the problem with that is I'm not sure how high giant wasps would fly. You know, insects don't usually fly as high as birds do. So I thought that there might be an issue with that because I really think these blue jays would be flying at maximum altitude so they could make the best speed that they can because the, anyway, I can get into that. So there was that issue with the giant wasps. I considered like winged kobolds, griffins, peritons, you know, any flying creature that I could think of that wasn't just way too powerful. I considered having a large number of smaller creatures like the giant wasps or the flying kobolds or having one big scary creature, blah, 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 blah. And what I ended up going with, what I decided to use ultimately was a manticore. And there were a few reasons for this. First of all, I thought the manticore would be more effective because manticore is like, I think it's like CR5. So it's actually a bit beyond what you would normally throw at a second level party. And I counted on the fact that at least one of the players would know that and would, you know, that would probably translate a little bit into the character pucker factor of, hey, this monster is actually like a pretty tough monster. You know, I'm not even sure if we should be trying to fight this at our level kind of thing. The other thing nice about the manticore is it was slower than the giant jays, which was a way to prevent the encounter from being too deadly because the player characters could just run away or fly away. It's like, if you guys just keep flying maximum speed, you're going to outpace it. It can't keep up with you. So that ensured that the combat would be relatively short, you know, just a round or two maybe, and then it's over, which minimizes the chance of a character, you know, getting incapacitated or their mount getting incapacitated and falling and dying and that kind of thing. And the other nice thing about the manticore is it has a ranged attack, because the problem with saying, well, I'm going to use a monster that's quite a bit slower than the bird they're flying, is it's like, well, then how does it even attack them at all? But the nice thing about the Manticore is it has a ranged attack. It can fire its tail spikes. So that made it make sense that it at least be able to get a few attacks off in that few moments that the player characters are actually within range. So that's what I did. I ended up using one Manticore, and I used my tactic that I've discussed on the podcast before of leaving an opening for bringing in more Manticores. I had the player character, they saw more Manticores in the distance, which also increased the perceived danger factor, even though these Manticores were quite a bit away. And I think I told the players that as like, as long as you keep going, these other Manticores can't get to you. They're too far away. But if you start circling and fighting this one Manticore, then, you know, maybe they could get to you. But if you just keep making the best speed you can, they're not going to be able to catch you. But they were there if I needed, like if they just annihilated this Manticore, I could have brought more Manticores in if I needed to. But mainly they were just there to raise the perceived danger level of, oh crap, you know, we can't screw around too much because there's more of these. And it was also kind of a nudge to what I thought was the best strategy. Because, you know, one thing I commonly do when I create an encounter is I try to anticipate different ways the players could react to it. Now, I'm not going to be able to guess exactly what they do, but I try to anticipate general strategies that I think they might use. So this particular encounter, I have I have them flying on flying mounts. I have a Manticore flying and intercepts them and is able to get a few ranged attacks off, but eventually they could outpace it. You know, there's different strategies they could take there. They could just keep going and just fly as fast as they can and just run away, basically, which I think is what they, quote, should do, has the greatest potential of them surviving the encounter. And again, my purpose here is not for them to kill a Manticore and get its treasure or whatever. My purpose is just to show them the world is dangerous. I don't care if they kill the Manticore or not. I don't care if they fight the Manticore or not. I just want them to encounter it and deal with it in some way. So running away would be the smartest thing to do, I think, and the easiest and the most likely to succeed. But they could decide to full out fight it and not try to get away and completely engage it. So those were the kind of the two general strategies I thought about. And like I said, you know, if they stop to engage it, now it can use its melee attacks in addition to its ranged attack. There's much greater chance of one of them getting knocked out of the saddle or their bird getting hurt enough that it can't fly and it falls, which is not something I really want to happen. I don't want to have someone roll a new character after the first session. And there's also the possibility that these other Manticores in the distance could get close enough to join the fight if they're kind of hanging out in one place fighting this Manticore. So to my mind, running away is a smart thing to do and is what I hope that they do, because again, I don't want a TPK. I don't want a player character dying in the first literally the first encounter of the campaign. So I felt like this was this was kind of nudging them in the direction that I hope that they would go, that I think is the I'm losing my train of thought. I just thought that this was the best way to get the results that I wanted, which is basically just a quick encounter, not a fight to the death, that the PCs can basically run away from. So I can talk about that more when I don't want to get too much into what actually happened, because I'm going to do a separate episode on that. If I get into that, this will be ungodly long. So that was kind of my thought process. So again, anytime with an encounter or anything I'm doing, I'm always keeping in mind, what am I trying to accomplish here? And I felt like the Manticore was a good way to accomplish what I was trying to accomplish. And the fact that it is a higher CR monster further, I felt would further motivate the player characters to not try to stand and fight it, but instead retreat, which in that way minimize the chance of a character dying. Now, you know, in the end, it's up to the players, right? And there's only so much I can do. And if the players decide, no, we're going to stand and fight this thing, then that's what they're going to do. I'm not going to tell them they can't do that. But I'm trying, through the setup of the encounter and what's happening, I'm trying to nudge them in the direction I want them to go, which is, you know, you're welcome to trade some blows with this thing as you go by, but I really hope that you keep going and get away. Because if you stand and fight, you know, it's kind of dicey whether you could even defeat this manacore. And then there's the other ones coming as well. And again, I have those other ones in the distance to further reinforce, like, standing and fighting might not be a good idea. Let's see. So Rob asked if the birds took any damage. And yeah, one of them did, but Steve's character healed it. And luckily it wasn't enough to, like, incapacitate it. Let's see. Rob says, air gets colder and thinner at altitude. We usually select altitude for best fuel burn rate, which don't think applies with a bird, and best tailwind, or at least headwind. Yeah. Yeah. So Rob, you're reading my mind today, sir. So yeah, I used to be a pilot or took pilot lessons, and that's what I was thinking of. But yeah, it's kind of thinking in the back of my head too. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if that would apply to birds. And actually it might with a bird. I don't know. See, now I'm really curious because the air is thinner. So it might actually, birds might actually fly more efficiently at a lower altitude than a higher one. But it's complicated, right? Like Rob's saying here, there's also the winds, and winds can be different speeds and even different directions at different altitudes. So yeah, it's kind of complicated, but now I really want to, do some research and figure out, how altitude affects the flight of birds. But yeah, Rob, that's totally what I was thinking of back in my flying days and knowing that, you get better fuel efficiency at higher altitudes. Yeah, so that's what I was thinking of. So yeah, that probably actually doesn't apply to the flight of a bird, the more I think about it. So Rob is in my head today. But that's great. That's great. So at least someone knows what I'm trying to say. All right. Let's see. I don't see any more questions in the chat. And, you know, let's see here. How long it... Yeah, I kind of want to go into talking about what happened with session one. But I think this is getting long, so I should probably do that in another video. So I think we'll wrap this up for now. If you have any further questions about kind of how I prepare for this session, definitely let me know. You can comment on this video, or email me, or whatever. And then the next video in this series, I'm gonna do kind of a post-game discussion of session one. And it's weird today because I've actually already run session one. So I'm trying to, like, keep these separate, so I don't have like a 3-hour video, but yeah, in the next video, I'll talk about what actually went down, on session one and talk about how things went. So yeah, I will try to get that out in the near future. So thank you to everyone who watched us live. And again, if you missed this live and you have a question or comment, just post it to the video and I'll check those when I do the next one. So yeah, looking forward to hearing from you. And I hope this has been helpful. And I'll see you next time. Well, that's going to wrap up episode 186 of Game Master's Journey. If you'd like to follow me, you can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at LexStarwalker. You can also call the Game Master's Journey voicemail number and leave me a message. If your question, feedback is entertaining or enlightening, or both, you might even hear your message on the show. That number is 951-GMJ-LEX-1. That's 951-465-5391. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I would love to hear from you. You can find the show notes for this episode at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey, as well as links to connect with the Game Master's Journey community on Google Plus and Discord, where you can share ideas, questions, and stories with other listener GMs. If you'd like to support the show, the best way you can help us out is by becoming a patron. You can find out all about becoming a patron at patreon.com/StarWalkerStudios. I'd like to give a shout out and a huge thank you to my Tier 5 patron, Steve. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can also check the bottom of the show notes for all the other ways you can support the show, including purchasing a t-shirt or my D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth, at starwalkerstudios.com, or by using my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon. I hope you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Tranceboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey.